You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Wisconsin and beyond. I'm Maggie Dawn. And as it is 3 o'clock, it is time for Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money, a joint production of the Patriotic Millionaires and the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm really excited today to be joined by a woman I would call probably the preeminent expert in this area. Her name is Ai-Jen Poo. She has been a labor leader, an award-winning organizer, a leading voice in the women's movement, and she is the current president of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and the executive director of Caring Across Generations and a trustee of the Ford Foundation. She is, again, I think one of the preeminent experts on the care economy, which obviously is very close to women's issues. And she is the author of the celebrated book, The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elder Boom in a Changing America. We've been talking this week about these big policy reforms that we need to fix our economy. And we need to focus in today on this care economy because women, frankly, have been doing unpaid work for far, far too long. And even where we're compensated, where people who work in the care economy are compensated, it is often at absolutely ridiculously low wages. And this is something that every single one of us will need at some point in our lives, whether for our children, our parents as they age, or ourselves as we age. Everybody's living longer, and many of us need some help as we enter into those golden years. So again, here to talk about both the present and future and the past of the care economy, our guest today is Ai-Jen Poo. Welcome, Ai-Jen. Thank you so much for making time. It's really a privilege to talk with you.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to talk to you. And I'm a huge Wisconsin fan, so this is excellent. Yes.
Go Badgers. I love it.
Yes.
And go swing states, right? that too. Tell us what is the care economy, in case I oversimplified things, and tell us about the state of care in the U.S. How's it going? Who's doing this work?
Ooh, such big questions. Okay, so when we say care economy, we are talking about all of the relationships and work and energy that goes into making sure that children, older adults, people with disabilities, the people that we love have the supports that they need to live with dignity. And for children to be able to have the care and the nurturing and the attention that they need at a crucial time in their lives, 0 to 5, to be able to realize their full potential in the world. So we're talking about childcare and early education. We are talking about senior care, disability care in all kinds of settings. There's center-based, nursing homes, home-based. There's all kinds of settings, but it's all care. And it's all about making sure that our families across generations have the supports that they need in order to live and have a quality of life. And it is especially impacts people, adult age working people, because care is also the work that makes all other work possible. Yes. I think Senator Casey from Pennsylvania said a couple of years ago, he said, you know, some people need a bridge or a tunnel to get to work, and other people need childcare. Other people need home care. And it is such a kind of, it's a foundation of our economy that we have never really talked about in that way until I think the pandemic started to change that when the pandemic brought the care crisis to everyone's doorstep. And suddenly we were all like trying to figure out Zoom, and our kids were crawling on us, and our parents were on lockdown in nursing homes or thousands of miles away. And we had no idea when we were going to see them again. And all of a sudden we were like, oh, wow, this is really hard. And we actually can't do it alone. And so when we talk about the care economy, we're also talking about how do we invest in the systems, policies, and programs that make it possible for us to care for the people that we love, especially while we're working.
It's so critical. You, in your introduction, you talked about, again, care for children, older adults, and those with disabilities so that we can all live with some dignity.
That's right.
This basic idea that each human being deserves dignity. And then the secondary bridging idea for those that tend to be very focused on economic growth and all of those things. None of that happens unless and until we figure out how to operate the care economy in a more just and equitable way to bring about greater dignity. That growth depends on the care economy. Thank you for making that so very clear. How many people are we talking about here?
Oh, so we have new data from RAND Corporation that just came out last week. 105.6 million Americans today are caregivers.
Wow.
Not about history, but like right now. That is like a third of the country.
I was going to say that's a third of our population, one out of every three people.
It's a massive amount of people who are in the care economy. And the truth is, every single one of us in this country is touched by the care economy. Each of us, and the former First Lady Rosalynn Carter once said, there's only four kinds of people in the world: people who are caregivers or will be, people who need care or will need care. Like literally, this is a topic, even if we aren't currently caregivers, which 105.6 million of us are, this is an issue that's going to touch every single one of us at some point. And then the other piece that you mentioned earlier, which is so important, is there are actually professionals whose full-time job it is to work in the care economy, who get up every day and take care of our kids, who get up every day and make sure that our loved ones with disabilities are able to live full lives in the community, or to make sure that our aging parents actually have some autonomy and sense of, you know, ability to have choices and agency and quality of life and as they age. That work is so profoundly undervalued in our economy. If I were to tell you that the median income of a home care worker in the United States of America is $22,000 per year, literally, you can make more working in fast food in most states than you can working in the care economy. And no shade on fast food. Like, that is really important, dignified work also. But it just gives you a sense of how we have so deeply undervalued and just not supported this essential workforce, which, by the way, we're going to need for a pretty long time, because ChatGPT, no matter what you tell it, is not going to be able to take care of your parent, right? And you can't outsource this work.
You can't automate it. I mean, it's not AI. You can't outsource it. It requires human beings. Let's dig in. I mean, $22,000 a year, the average take-home pay of someone that works in the home care industry, when we know that the average median income that is required for a single adult with no children is around $40,000.
Right.
It is barely half that.
Right.
We know that working families, whether we're talking about elder care, child care, care for persons with disabilities, it is so expensive for middle-class families. First of all, why is it so expensive? And if it's so expensive, why are the people that provide this work paid so very little?
It's such a great question. And I get asked it a lot because it really doesn't add up. Like, the math isn't mathing.
Unintended and literally, right?
And literally, exactly. So there are fixed costs associated with operating a safe and quality childcare center, for example. And right now, our funding for childcare is this like patchwork of state and federal funding pots that is always under-resourced. And so these centers are trying to piece it together in order to stay operating. And if you can't piece it together with this patchwork of inconsistent funding from these different pots, then you're passing the expenses along to parents. Mm-hmm. And you're taking wages from workers. Like yeah. You really don't have a lot of options. And the thing about this is that care is a challenge or a problem that the market can't solve. I am a believer if the market can solve a problem, it absolutely should. But we have kind of left it to the market to address our collective need for care in this country in a way that no other G7 country in the world has ever done. We spend so little on care. Literally, like we spend about $500 on average per child per year for care.
Which is literally ridiculous.
And I mean, other G7 countries, it's like 14,000, 15,000. Yes. And even they are saying that that's not sufficient because care is such a fundamental shared need and priority of any society. And so the fact that we have so under-resourced collectively this huge part of infrastructure that we need and left it up to individual centers, individual parents, and individual workers to shoulder the cost, it's completely unsustainable. And that's where we are.
We're going to talk more. My very special guest for this episode of Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money is Ai-Jen Poo, a labor leader and organizer. She probably knows more about the care economy than almost anybody else in the country. She's written the book on it, The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elder Boom in a Changing America. We're going to come right back after these brief messages and continue to dig in. What does the tax code say about this? How do we make it more affordable? And what about this? I keep hearing that affordable care and fair wages are somehow incompatible, but that seems like a bunch of hooey to me. We'll ask all that and more when we come back here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked.
The Patriotic Millionaires also purchase advertising time on various civic media stations throughout Wisconsin.
Tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen. Pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch.
Well, 9 to 5. An incredibly appropriate song for this particular segment of Maggie and the Millionaires. Hello, folks. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We're in the 3 o'clock half hour block. And so it's Maggie and the Millionaires talking money, joined today by Ai-Jen Poo. She is the president of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, executive director of Caring Across Generations, and a trustee of the Ford Foundation, an expert on the care economy. Wow. 10,000 people turn 65 every day and 10,000 babies are born every day. And we know that the number of adults over the age of 85 is expected to more than double by 2040. I spent some time living in Denmark. It isn't like this there. Okay, and people can say whatever they want to say about Denmark and other G7 countries, but they have paid family and medical leave, right? And they make enormous investments in the care economy because it is acknowledged as a baseline need for everybody.
Right.
It seems to me we've created a system, this patchwork of funding sources, as well as the tax code, and that's what I want to ask you about next, that simply has devalued this. And it's having really disastrous effects on working families. Wealthy families, of course, they can manage this, but it's frankly middle class and working people, including folks that might consider themselves on the high end of middle class. I mean, it can empty bank accounts and really put incredible stress on families. How is the tax code affecting the care economy?
I do want to underscore what you just said, which is that it's creating enormous pressure. I mean, care is such a universal need.
Yeah.
And yet the only people who can really afford care in the United States of America are the uber wealthy, really rich people. You have to be rich, essentially, to be able to afford the care that you need for your families. Meanwhile, we all have families. So what are we supposed to do?
Yeah.
And that is exactly why the tax code exists, for the things that our society as a whole needs. We all contribute. We are all supposed to pay our fair share. But unfortunately, the way things have played out, the reality is that poor and working class and middle class families, like the people that I represent in the care workforce, end up paying way more than their fair share. And the wealthiest among us, the billionaires, the millionaires, and the corporations, are not paying their fair share at all. And what that means is that this resource that is supposed to exist for our society as a whole is not being invested in adequately. And the way it's being invested in is completely unfair.
Yeah.
But again, the overwhelming burden is on lower income and middle income people. And we already are holding it all.
Yes.
We're like paying out of pocket too much, and we're paying in the tax code too much, and the rich are not paying at all.
Yeah,
is the problem.
I've heard people use the imagery of like an incredibly heavy backpack, right? That's strapped onto someone. And when you have to provide care, it's like a next ton of bricks, more weights being added to that. It can break individuals. It's incredibly stressful. And the comparative image for the ultra wealthy is not just that the backpack is lighter. It's that the person carrying the backpack is enormous, a giant size, and it's not even a backpack. They don't even feel it. And again, if you care about childcare, then you care about tax policy. If you care about elder care, you have to care about tax policy. If each and every one of us was forced to pay to defend our own homes, right, for our own police force, if we were forced to pay to defend and individually defend our neighborhoods, we would never be able to afford that. Our taxes go to pay that. This is not unlike that. All of us need this to work better. And it's just not done this way in other developed Western countries. I wanted to ask you this question because, again, one of the candidates for vice president seemed to suggest that, like, well, the workable solution is just ask your in-laws to provide free childcare. And underlying it seemed to be this assumption that we can't both make it affordable and pay people a fair wage. And so people just need to like fill the gaps however they can, which again tends to privilege the very wealthy. And even our Family Medical Leave Act, that's unpaid leave, which only works for workers that can afford to take medical leave for no pay. Is this idea that we can't both pay people fairly and have affordable care, are those actually incompatible?
No, it's a completely false choice. And the idea that we could, first of all, grandparents are going to be caring for us no matter what, because care in America is an all hands on deck situation. Yeah. Maggie, you laid it out. We've got 10,000 babies born, 10,000 people turning 65. We're living longer than ever before. We are a country that needs just a lot of care right now. So even with a strong infrastructure in place, where we have a strong workforce, we have supported family caregivers, we're still going to need the grandparents. Yeah. We're going to need immigrants, non-immigrants. We're going to need everybody. And that is how it's supposed to be. Because it's not an either or. It's not either a personal responsibility or a societal responsibility. Actually, care is one of the most profound responsibilities and roles that we have in our lives. That's not going to change. What needs to change is our societal commitment to supporting it. Right. Yeah. And that has not happened. And the only way that happens is through the tax code. You raise the revenue to be able to invest in building new systems.
Very briefly, Jen, I'm sorry, we've got to put a pin in it, but I want to ask you this. What should people do if they're listening to help build a better care infrastructure? Very briefly, we got about 10 seconds left.
Make a plan to vote and vote for champions who are going to raise revenue and invest in care.
Thanks so much. That's Ai-Jen Poo, the president of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. I'm Maggie Dawn. We're going to be talking next about that very thing. Wisconsin Policy Forum president talking about $1.7 billion in savings if Wisconsin would just expand eligibility for Badger Care when we come back after these brief messages.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
What's up, Wisconsin and beyond? My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. My special thanks to Ai-Jen Poo, who joined me last segment for Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money. We were talking about the care economy and the care that we will either provide now or later, or the care that we will either need now or later. And while that wasn't directly about healthcare per se or medical insurance, boy, it sure relates, doesn't it? And that's why my next guest, so important to discuss this topic, frankly, and I would call it one of the most important recent reports and analyses conducted by the Wisconsin Policy Forum on the savings to Wisconsin taxpayers that could occur if Wisconsin expanded Medicare eligibility. We call it Badger Care Plus. Here in Wisconsin, if the eligibility for that was expanded. Joining me now is the president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, Jason Stein. Welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show, Jason.
Thank you, Maggie. Good to be with you.
And excuse me, I misspoke a moment again. Medicaid eligibility is what we're talking about. Again, AKA Badger Care here in the state of Wisconsin, as it's colloquially known. Give us the high level, Jason. What are we actually talking about? What's the, quote, expanded eligibility? Why would there be such enormous savings?
Right. So in Wisconsin right now, Badger Care covers adults who are not pregnant up to 100% of the federal poverty level. And no other of the other states that have not expanded Medicaid, particularly for adults without dependent children, without children at home, none of the other states covers any of those adults. So Wisconsin has already done quite a bit to expand Medicaid, but we've not gone up to 138% of the federal poverty level. So the difference for an individual would be right now we cover under Medicaid, Badger Care, up to $15,000 a year of income. If we went up to a little under $21,000, we would fully expand the program, and we'd be eligible for additional matching dollars from the federal government. Right now, childless adults alone, there's about 190,000 individuals in Wisconsin that are being covered at a higher cost rate to state taxpayers because we have not fully expanded the program.
And just a reminder to everybody, the federal poverty level for an individual is about $15,000. So when Jason says the Medicaid expansion to cover nearly 140% of the federal poverty level, we're not talking about folks making a ton of money here. We're talking about folks making very, very little money. As you were explaining, Jason, Wisconsin doesn't have what is often referred to as this coverage gap. In the other nine states that have not expanded Medicaid eligibility, they do not provide assistance, Medicaid rather, for folks up to 100% of the federal poverty level. So you have these people that exist in this gap. They can't acquire health insurance, public health insurance, and they're yet very, very low income. So again, just to distinguish from those other nine states, and listen, I'll say this, this is not Jason's opinion, it's mine. Folks, those other states are not really states that I'd like to be taking public policy guidance from. It's some of the states with extraordinarily high poverty levels. It's not a great look. And we've expanded it again to get to nearly 140% of the federal poverty level, Jason, as you mentioned. So why, and we're going to save Wisconsin taxpayers $1.7 billion. Why in heaven's name haven't we done this before? This has been around for a while, has it not?
It has been. You know, in Wisconsin, there's not a ballot measure. So citizen-led ballot initiative. So you really have to run things through the legislature. And there hasn't been a buy-in from the legislature for this proposal. Again, in Wisconsin, we're on really different footing from these other nine states, which are mostly in the South. In Wisconsin, our uninsured rate is 4.9%. That's 3 percentage points lower than the national rate of 7.9%. All these other non-expansion states are above the national average in terms of their uninsured rate. And one reason we're lower, again, is we have put this funding of state taxpayers into expanding the program. The only problem with that is, you know, the additional cost that comes with it. So in looking at the issue, the policy forum put forward a range of options from doing nothing up to fully expanding the program that elected officials at the state level could look at.
Why is it that state government hasn't done this, at least according to Kirsten Johnson, the secretary designee of the Department of Health Services? Already, the state has spent $2.4 billion in its state taxpayer dollars that it could have received from the federal government and saved our state a huge chunk of money that, you know, we could maybe pay for help pay childcare for or something else. What's the hang up in the state legislature? I don't get it.
Well, it's true that over the next 2 years, the estimates are the state would save $1.7 billion for state taxpayers if we expanded the program. Some of the arguments that have been made have included the fact that Medicaid does reimburse less than private pay insurers. There would be some federal tax credits that people receive who are currently part of the Affordable Care Act exchanges. These are people between 100 and 138% of the federal poverty level. So there would be some offsetting loss of federal aid to the state if you expand it, although again, there'd still be a substantial net benefit. I think, you know, one reason why the healthcare providers may have some hesitance about this is being uncertain how the money would be used. So if we do expand the program, gain those savings, are we going to use it to try and boost Medicaid reimbursement rates? Are we going to use it to lower taxes? Are we going to pour it into education or childcare or some other priority, as you say? And so that's another reason why perhaps some providers in Wisconsin have not gotten wholeheartedly behind it in the way that they may have in some other states. Again, also in Wisconsin, you're not going to get the same decrease in the uninsured rate that you would in other places because we've already done a lot of the work that has yet to happen in places like Texas or South Carolina.
Right. So if I can break this down, I've heard a couple of things. Basically, and again, this is my sort of pejorative opinion or simplification, if you will, Jason. Healthcare providers aren't sure they're going to make as much money. So they're not fully supportive of this, even though it would add 90,000 more people would be insured and thus receive preventative care and be consumers of medical care. Secondly, we already have a very low uninsured rate, so we don't need to do any more. Right. Pardon me for saying this, but isn't a tax dollar savings, even with some of the federal offsets, again, it's a huge net plus in the billion plus to Wisconsin taxpayers. Why do Wisconsin taxpayers need to care about whether or not health providers are making maximum profits? We all know, I mean, anybody that's gotten a bill from your insurance or, heaven forbid, you're uninsured from a medical provider, seems they just make the prices up anyways. From a pure taxpayer perspective, I don't know why in a state where we hear a lot of talk about respecting taxpayers and lowering taxes, why this hasn't been a gimme. Yes, we've got a low uninsured rate, but why is it not a better thing to insure more people, 90,000 Wisconsinites, for a lower Wisconsin taxpayer cost?
Well, it's true that 40 of the 50 states have gone this route. So most states have done this. And it's also true that the estimates are that 70 to 90,000 individuals would enroll in Medicaid if you expanded the program. Now, most of those would not be gaining coverage for the first time. They would probably be moving coverage that would be better and more generous for them. And then there would be something on the order of 20 or 25,000 individuals who are uninsured that would gain coverage. So, you know, that's what it would do on the, you know, state resident side. On the provider side, you know, on the one hand, many state officials would probably look to state government and state government's bottom line first. You know, we have seen some communities like Eau Claire where they have had healthcare provider shutdowns where, you know, in particularly in more rural areas of the state, you may have some stressed healthcare providers where it really matters what their bottom line is in terms of ensuring a continuity of care. At the same time, you have to look not just at the Medicaid reimbursement rate, but also how many people are covered, how many uninsured people are coming into the emergency room, because there's also a charity care concern that hospitals have for, you know, provide healthcare services that they're giving out to people who don't have any coverage at all and are essentially leaving them with the bill. So there's a lot to balance here, but there's also in Wisconsin the ability to use these savings to address some of the trade-offs in a way that if you are in Texas, there's just going to be an increase in state Medicaid spending if you expand the program, and you're not necessarily going to have money left over to address some of the trade-offs that might come with it.
Yeah, understood. You know, it's interesting because I've heard these discussions from healthcare providers. Certainly, I think the continuity of care is something that would merit, you know, some deep analysis, especially to make sure that all of our rural folks, all of our rural friends and family and neighbors, that they have that continuity of care. Again, that needs some specificity. I really don't like to take the word of for-profit organizations when they're telling me those things. Sure. And you know, when we talk about charity care and some of the write-offs, again, many of these hospitals are 501c3 and do not pay taxes, and thus the charity care is built into their business model in order to maintain their tax exempt status. So of course, very interesting here. I'll just say this, Jason, and again, not your words. We're talking to Jason Stein, president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. They just released a brand new report about Wisconsin taxpayer savings of north of $1.7 billion estimated if eligibility for Medicaid called Badger Care here in Wisconsin was expanded. There's obviously a bit of a partisan tinge here, is there not, as well, Jason?
Sure. I mean, You know, most of the states that have not expanded the program to this point are red states. Wisconsin would probably be, you know, the more blue or purple of those remaining states. And there has been, you know, a partisan approach to this in the legislature where Democrats have supported it, Republicans have not. You know, we've been working on this project for, we really started discussions about it a year ago. So we're in no way rolling it out because of the elections. But, you know, there may be some shift in the composition of the legislature, and that may have some impact. You know, another thing that may have impact, you know, in the coming years is the federal government did a couple years back sweeten the pot in terms of providing, you know, quite a bit more additional one-time funds for states that expanded. And you're seeing the fact that more states have done it nationally. So all of those things may factor in next session as the legislature debates it. I think it's sort of a still probably a long-term issue for the state, but one I think that there's a healthy discussion and a productive discussion that could potentially be had to address a lot of the challenges that we as a state have over the next few years, particularly in the healthcare area.
Thanks so much. That's Jason Stein, president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Jason, where can they find your new report?
It's at WIS, as in the first three letters of Wisconsin, policyforum.org. It's there for free for anybody who wants to go and check it out.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Jason. Folks, we'll be back with my closing thoughts on this very issue after these brief messages. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, Wisconsin and beyond. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. It's always a pleasure to have my very next guest on. Even if you live outside of Milwaukee County, what this county executive has done, I think, sets an example for county executives across the state in both fiscal management and making that taxpayer dollar stretch, and also ensuring the continuity of the delivery of services. If you live in a county outside of Milwaukee, you should care what this guy is doing, because again, he sets the bar here in Wisconsin. Also, as an example, I think perhaps not just that fiscal responsibility, not just making sure people get the services they need, but the idea of legitimate collaboration and cooperation across the aisles. This gentleman certainly helped set the standard. His name is County Executive David Crowley. And just yesterday, he gave his annual budget address. Welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show, David. It's a pleasure to have you.
It is so amazing to be on with you. And thank you for that amazing introduction. I truly appreciate it. Always a pleasure to be on with you.
Let's start. This was not an easy budget. I certainly spent a lot of time on my show talking about Act 12, which was the legislation, groundbreaking legislation, the first of its kind in a generation in the state of Wisconsin, that enabled Milwaukee County to adopt a sales tax to try to start to repair these structural budget deficits. And yet we still went into the 2025 budget cycle looking to close some gaps. You had to shore some things up for 2024. Tell folks about those structural budget deficit challenges that we face still today and into the future, and why they still exist.
Absolutely. And I appreciate the way that you actually framed that question, because Wisconsin Act 12, it did help us bring in millions of dollars annually to continue to invest in programs and services, as well as the additional shared revenue that we're getting as a county and other municipalities are getting, right? But that does not mean that we are out of the woods yet. We still have a structural deficit. And I know a lot of your listeners, a lot of people out there are saying, like, what is a structural deficit? What is that? It's just a random, or it's the same as a gap in the budget? Not quite. And so our structural deficit is that we are capped at how many property taxes that we can actually collect from all property taxpayers right here within Milwaukee County. And that's not only unique to us, that's across the entire state. And so even though we are capped at about 1% of the net new construction to being able to raise property taxes, our expenses are actually outpacing the amount of money that we have bringing in. And so I'll give you a prime example. As counties, we are responsible for delivering services that are state mandated. And when you think about courts, when you think about public safety, those are our responsibilities. But we need a greater and better partnership with the state of Wisconsin to make sure that inflation and the cost of those services are keeping in line with our ability to actually pay for them. And unfortunately, we're utilizing too many of our local property tax dollars to pay for state services and not being able to invest directly back into our local communities and our local priorities.
And if I understand this correctly, Mr. County Executive, Milwaukee County, even with this increase in sales tax and the increase in shared revenue that came about through Act 12, we're still a net contributor to the state budget, meaning we send more tax dollars than Milwaukee County gets back. Am I correct?
You are absolutely correct. I don't have the exact dollar amount, but when you think about the amount of money that we collect in property taxes and sales taxes and different types of fees, particularly as it relates to the court system, those dollars go directly to the state and they make decisions on how we're going to receive those dollars here locally. And unfortunately, as you pointed out, it has not kept up with inflation. And quite frankly, we've seen a reduction in the amount of shared revenue payments that we received prior to the Wisconsin Act 12 Act.
So still some inequities there about how the state treats the economic engine of Wisconsin. But I do want to ask you about this. While there is a 2.8% tax levy increase in Milwaukee County in 2025, your budget summary also noted that property taxes are going down 3%. How is that possible?
Absolutely. So one, a lot of this can be credited to, you know, Governor Tony Evers and the partnership we created with the Wisconsin State Legislature with Wisconsin Act 12, right? Those dollars were able to pay down a lot of the local property tax dollars that we were putting, quite frankly, into our pension system. And that was taking about $100 million of the $300 million property taxes that we collect every single year. And so even though we are going to see an increase of about 2.8%, because the mill rate has actually come down, that's going to actually lower or in some cases keep those property taxes stagnant, because you do have to realize that there are municipalities who go through assessments and we don't control how those homes in those local municipalities are assessed. But again, this 2.8% increase in property tax levy is still below the property taxes that folks were paying, homeowners and businesses were paying back in the year 2020. So this is good news for us within Milwaukee County. But again, we still have a long road ahead of us when it comes down to making sure that we can invest in the local priorities like our parks, like mental health, like public transit and things of that nature.
So, folks, if you're listening, ask your state representatives and senators, are you treating Milwaukee County fairly? Are they getting a fair share of shared revenue? Before I have to let you go, Mr. County Executive, I wanted to send you my personal congratulations. I just got word that you are named National Governing Magazine's one of their public officials of the year. You're going to be on the cover. I could think of no better person than to represent the state of Wisconsin for this honor. Congratulations, sir.
Well, thank you so much. I truly appreciate it. But when you think about a recognition and an honor like that, it's nothing that I do on my own. So I want to say thank you to the hardworking employees of Milwaukee County and our partners in collaboration for helping us move the needle forward every single day.
That's Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley giving his 2025 budget address yesterday. We're going to leave it there. I'm Maggie Dawn. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But it's always better when we stand.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.